This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, we have a report from Sudan, where Khartoum saw the largest protests in several months today, with police officers firing many rounds of tear gas to drive away demonstrators. And Tunisia's prime minister designate has announced the formation of a coalition government. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: new Boko Haram attacks have displaced more than 3,000 people along Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria in the past 3 months. Authorities say the Nigerian Islamist militants torched houses, abducted, raped, and looted, creating panic among villagers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the northern Cameroon town of Mora near the Nigerian border.
27-year-old Cameroonian Alida Manudi is getting help from the Association of Muslim Women in the northern town of Mora on Nigeria's border after escaping from Boko Haram. Last week, she managed to flee the border village of Tuski, where the Islamist militants were holding her captive as a sex slave.
Un jour, j'ai volé les clés. Je me suis enfui. Il me frappait même deux fois.
She says at the first opportunity, she fled a hut in the bush, where she was repeatedly raped by several men. She told one of the men that she was menstruating, says Manudi, but the man still raped her. Manudi says she trekked for 3 hours before getting help from a Nigerian fuel vendor who brought her to Mora. Manudi says she was among 12 people Boko Haram abducted from a village, some for a second time. The Association of Muslim Women is treating her and 16 other women who escaped Boko Haram in recent months. Cameroon's military says the Islamist militants have in the past 3 months stepped up raids on villages along the border. Midjiyawa Bakari, the governor of Cameroon's far north region, says the terrorists cross over from Nigeria in groups of 10 to 20, torch houses, abduct civilians, and steal livestock and grain. He asked villagers to help inform Cameroon security forces of attacks.
We have to call upon population to help, to bring information, to work hand in hand with forces of law and civil authority, and by that way, it is obvious that the result will be there.
Bakari says the wave of attacks is a consequence of a porous border and a dry season, during which it is easier for militants to move around than it is during the wet season. He denied the attacks were made worse by the military withdrawing from several border posts to fight rebels in the English-speaking Northwest. United Nations officials, including the UN coordinator in Cameroon, Allegra Bauchi, have been visiting camps to which thousands of people were displaced by the Boko Haram attacks this month. Bauchi says they are in urgent need of humanitarian aid.
We saw over 3,000 people in the area of Mora and Kurgi. And so we talked about the needs of these people, which are humanitarian needs. We talked about how we are trying to help them. But we also talked about the importance of making sure that we really help these populations regain their livelihoods.
Neither the United Nations nor the government of Cameroon gave an estimate of the number of people killed or wounded in the attacks. The local tabloid L'Œil du Sahel, which specializes in reporting on Boko Haram, estimates at least 90 people have been killed since mid-November. Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting for the past 11 years to create an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria's northeast, but the attacks have spread to neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. When the fighting reached Cameroon in 2014, President Paul Biya declared war on the militants. The Islamist group has killed more than 36,000 people, displaced over 2 million, and left more than 7 million in need of humanitarian aid. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
Amnesty International has urged Angola to investigate and prosecute everyone involved in corruption and looting of state resources. The call came during a roundtable discussion in Johannesburg after leaked documents showed how former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos's multi-billionaire daughter Isabel and others connected individuals allegedly used international banks and other links to siphon money and resources from the state. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The Human Rights Watchdog has described the contents of the leaked documents, now known as Luanda Leaks, as a wake-up call for Angola's government and people. Debros Muchena, Regional Director at Amnesty International for Southern Africa, urged the government to make sure that all, not just some, who are found guilty of the alleged economic injustices are brought to book.
The investigations that are being undertaken for cases of corruption has to be based on principles of fairness, so that we do not use the criminal justice system as a vehicle of political persecution through prosecution.
Renowned Angolan human rights activist Daniel Ntoni Nzinga said although he wants Isabel dos Santos to account for her actions, he is worried that the focus has been shifted to her as if she is the only one who looted.
But the looting was not just Isabel, but it was a very general practice in the country. Our morale as a country, as a people, has been very seriously damaged. Even those who knew what was happening could not make any statement or could not come up publicly to say something wrong.
Muchena concurred, arguing that it is also crucial to punish those who allegedly provided safe haven for the looted state funds beyond Angola's borders.
So I think it's important that the world converge around bringing corporates to account in the manner in which they've participated in looting or in processes that relates to illicit outflows of money, so that that money is contained back into the country to address the deficit of socioeconomic rights, education, health and water in Angola.
The leaked documents reveal how Isabel dos Santos, Africa's richest woman, allegedly looted state resources and funds through lucrative deals, using hundreds of companies and subsidiaries in more than 40 countries. Ntoni Nzinga says if the allegations are proved to be true, she and other looters not mentioned in the leaks should do the honest thing.
I will take the advantage of what Matthew said when Jesus went to spend time in his house. And then he said, those I have taken things away, I will give them back four times.
The administration of João Lourenço, who took over from long-time ruler José Eduardo dos Santos, has been hailed by many for cracking the whip on those involved in corrupt activities under dos Santos' rule. However, his critics accuse him of selective justice by turning a blind eye to his own past acts of corruption and those close to him. The Angolan court has ordered that all of Isabel dos Santos' assets be frozen. She has pleaded innocence, describing the freeze as politically motivated. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The International Division of the High Court in Kampala has overturned the 18-year jail sentence for activist Stella Nyanzi over her Facebook post on President Yoweri Museveni's mother. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
I could sing him a song. Yeah. I've been accused. For immorality. I've been accused for immorality, for being an immoral woman. That's a song, it's a real song. Yeah. No, so I've been accused. Immorality. I've been accused. I'm supposed to dance immorality.
Stella Nyanzi appeared in court this morning in a jovial mood, sure she would win an appeal of the cyber harassment charge that the government pursued against her last year. Nyanzi was convicted in August for a poem she published on her Facebook page, reportedly ridiculing Museveni's mother, Esteri Kokundeka. Her lawyer presented 10 grounds for the appeal, saying the lower court had no jurisdiction and that Nyanzi was never allowed to address the court when the prosecution closed its case. Justice Henry Peter Adonyo ruled in favor of Nyanzi and ordered her immediate release.
The judgment and findings in the lower court are set aside for they were illegal, as the court did not have jurisdiction. The conviction against the appellant is hereby quashed. The appellant is ordered to be released immediately unless he's held over some other lawful charges. Any right of appeal by any aggrieved party in this matter must be exercised within the meaning of appropriate law.
Nyanzi could not hide her joy.
I am glad to be here. I'm glad to be released. Why was I in prison?
I want to know.
I want to understand why the lower courts in Uganda are abusing the rights and freedoms that are constitutionally provided for all Ugandans. The right to a fair hearing is a constitutional right that is non-derogatable. Why was I in court for all these months?
Chaos erupted at the court after Nyanzi was taken back to Luzira prison to sign papers for her release. Police fired live bullets to disperse hundreds of her supporters. She then was released and moved through Kampala streets with a huge procession. Nyanzi was the first person to be charged with cyber harassment in Uganda. She has been repeatedly harassed, arrested and detained over her social media posts against Museveni and his government. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. New Boko Haram attacks have displaced more than 3,000 people along Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria in the past 3 months. And Amnesty International has urged Angola to investigate and prosecute everyone involved in corruption and looting of state resources. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Khartoum saw the largest protests in several months today, with police officers firing many rounds of tear gas to drive away demonstrators. The protesters were angry over the military's dismissal of mid-ranking officer who became well known last year for his support of South Sudan's revolution. Journalist Izzaldin Arbab was on the scene of the protest today and spoke with VOA's Jason Patinkin about what he saw.
There were many protesters near to presidential palace who protest the army's decision to send to retirement several officers, including some of who supported Sudanese protests during the revolution, so that people protested to suppress their anger at the decision of the army. 100 guards are near to presidential palace in Khartoum, so security forces fear tear gas, and people start running, and then shortly started clashes between the security forces and then some protesters. So protesters just came back, and then they met like roadblocks, and still now I can see on the area of Khartoum the tear gas.
Who was it? Who were the security forces? Was it the army? Was it the police?
I saw police and also the army there. But I think the one who feared the tear gas were wearing your police uniform.
When you were there at the protest and you were with the protesters, what were they saying to you? What were they expressing in their chants, in their protests?
Chants, people are saying the Sudanese army is still full of Bashir's regime supporters. So now they want to clean all Bashir supporters, because one of the goals of the Sudanese revolution, which many people died for, was to remove Bashir's regime completely from the country. The officer which he dismissed yesterday by the decision of the army was one of the big supporters of the revolution of Sudan. So they think Bashir's guys in the army did that.
Now, can you tell a bit about this specific army officer who was dismissed? Who was he and why is he so important?
His name is Muhammad al-Sadiq. Muhammad al-Sadiq is the first person in the army that he says publicly that he's not going to follow the order of the general of the army, and he's going to support the Sudanese protest. So he decided to support to the revolution before the army, even before the general of the army. That's why people love him so much. I think people still love him so much, and that's why you see this is one of the biggest protests in months.
And
it's still going on since 1 o'clock, and still the protests are going on.
How is the government justifying the dismissal of this officer?
The army on yesterday's statement said they dismissed him because he made like many mistakes. For example, as the statement of the army says, in June last year, he stormed with some officers. He stormed a police station and he violated some rules.
And you said this is the biggest protest that you have seen in Khartoum in months. How many people do you think that there were in the streets today, or there are in the streets today?
Okay, the first group which I saw, and I got tear gas from the security force, were like hundreds, but that was the first group. And it was said then many were coming from Bahri, the south city of Khartoum, and also many others, also hundreds others were coming from other sites also from the capital.
That was journalist Izzaldin Arbab in Khartoum speaking with VOA's Jason Patenkin. Tunisia's Prime Minister-designate Lios El Fakhfakh has announced the formation of a coalition government after coming to an agreement with the Ennahda Party, which has 53 seats in the 217-member parliament. The proposed government must be approved by the deeply fragmented parliament, as Tunisia faces a series of long-term economic challenges which threaten to undermine public trust in the young democracy. Tunisia needs to borrow about $3 billion internationally in 2020 to meet spending commitments. The IMF was waiting for the new government to start talks over a review of the IMF loan program. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, about whether the formation of the new cabinet could end the political crisis and facilitate the IMF loan.
Yes, it ends the short political crisis that lasted since September, because it was a crisis of forming a government, in part because what was called the Carthage Pact, the government by national unity, which had pretty much run Tunisia from 2013 to 2019, had fallen apart, and many of the parties didn't want a national unity government, and that forced Tunisia into discussions of a majoritarian government. So that crisis is over, but the underlying political crisis, the one caused by the revolution, and the other one caused by the crisis of 2013 that I referred to, will still go on, because Tunisia has a lot of different strong political points of view that will continue to compete and contradict each other, and that's always a risk to destabilize the whole democratic transition. But for now, we've gotten over this crisis.
The proposed government must be approved by the deeply fragmented parliament in Tunisia. With this latest agreement with Ennahda, which has 53 seats in the 217-member parliament, win a confidence vote?
It's likely. Of course, we don't know for sure. I was doing the math this morning, and it looks like we have 106 votes from five parties, needed to get to 109, and so they need 3 independent votes of the 12 independents. So it looks like we'll get over the hump, but that's kind of rough because that means you have a majority, you know, plus one, and that's a fragile ruling majority. Tunisia has 18 parties in parliament. 3 of the 7 biggest ones are not involved in this government. And you could imagine pretty easily the government coalition falling apart because this isn't a larger national unity government. So the threat is probably less for this week, but for the coming months and into the first year of it, we could have the potential for a government collapse.
Tunisia faces a series of long-term economic challenges which threaten to undermine the public trust in the young democracy. Tunisia also needs to borrow about $3 billion internationally in this year to meet spending commitments. The IMF was awaiting for the new government to start talks over its loan. Could the formation of the new cabinet in Tunisia facilitate such loan?
Absolutely. So one of the reasons this government is being formed by this prime minister with these ministers is to continue and improve the conversation with the IMF, and the IMF will take action as a result of this government formation if it goes through. But it doesn't deal with the underlying problem of the IMF and the Tunisian government, because we have an unemployment issue in Tunisia, and the IMF will want to cut government spending on employees. And we have an inflation problem in Tunisia, and that's caused in part by the overspending. And if you start cutting fiscally to fix inflation, you have another further creation of unemployment and other government services that go away. So we have the problem we've always had with the IMF, that they try to cut government spending into fiscal health rather than stimulating fiscal health first and then cutting later. And until the IMF figures out a way to stimulate countries better post-revolutions, perhaps with easier credit, we'll continue to have these types of fiscal crises after every political transition, after every revolution, that have unsustainable solutions.
That was VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy speaking with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.